From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Has there been doping? Yes. Has there been Tour de France caliber doping? No. Ahead on Only a Game, what's going on at the world's most famous and infamous cycling event? Also, the attempt of double amputee Oscar Pistorius to make South Africa's Olympic team. Major League Soccer looks for some elbow and knee room on American pitches. And remembering Sugar Ray Leonard's theft of Marvelous Marvin Hagler's championship belt. Also ahead, bonfires, boating, basketball, and breathing comfortably at asthma camp.
A lot of these kids have never even been in the country. They've never even been to a spot like this. It's a beautiful place. Everything is brand new. It's like a brand new kitten just born, and they're walking on the grass. So you're going to see them wide-eyed. I mean, it's just amazing.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Today, those riders strong, healthy, and clean enough to still be competing in the Tour de France set off from the town of Nîmes, known for the success of its many local sporting teams, to a spa town on the edge of the Alps called Digne-les-Bains, where, according to the official Tour de France website, the clean air attracts many different species of butterflies. Maybe the riders will notice the aforementioned clean air and butterflies. Maybe they'll be too tired after racing 120.9 miles to do so. Maybe ESPN's Bonnie D. Ford will know which. Bonnie, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, it's great to be on.
After 13 stages and roughly 1,402.2 miles, how tired are these riders?
Well, they're tired, Bill, but they're also, at this point, conserving energy for the Alps stages ahead, which are most likely going to decide the race. So the tactics the last couple of days have been pretty predictable. The peloton lets a couple guys go up the road. They get some face time with their sponsors. They play around for a while. The peloton reels them back in, and there's a bunch sprint at the end for the 10, 12 guys who really are in contention for that sort of thing. And the rest of the pack stays together. The guys who are in overall contention get protected by their lieutenants. And, you know, rolling together, you expend a lot less energy than rolling alone. So that's been kind of the story of the last couple days.
On Thursday, Mark Cavendish became the first Brit to win three stages of the Tour. And yesterday he took his fourth stage, which makes me think this guy's got to be mighty fine at bicycle racing. So how is it that he's won four stages and he's still only in 144th place out of 158 riders?
He's a sprinter, obviously. So in the mountain stages or even a stage with any climbing in it, he's going to take up the rear of the peloton and not try to do much that day. And then when he does win a stage, because the peloton finishes so closely behind him, he doesn't really gain a big time advantage. So that's why he's got a lot of glory on one end and not a lot of glory in the overall standing.
Cadel Evans was a favorite heading into this year's race after being the only top three competitor from last year's Tour to return, and the saga of how he took the yellow jersey on Monday proves that the Tour still certainly has compelling storylines even after the retirement of Lance Armstrong and, of course, the decade-long doping scandal. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Cadel has the jersey by 1 second over Frank Schleck of Luxembourg. Cadel is a very, very strong all-around rider. He's a good climber, a very good time trialer. But he's the kind of guy who has generally followed other guys' wheels in the mountains instead of attacking aggressively. His team, Silence Lotto, the Silence half of that, by the way, is a sponsor that makes a snore relief medication. I'm not kidding. Cadel, however, is not a sleep-inducing rider. The support team that he has probably is not nearly as strong as Schleck's team, CSC Saxo Bank. which actually has kind of a double threat in Frank and Carlos Sastre, a Spanish rider. But in this equation, we cannot ignore Denis Menchov, who's a Russian leader of a Dutch team, Rabobank, and then Christian Vandeveld, who's now in third place at 38 seconds back. He's the leader of the Garmin Chipotle team. A very interesting story. He was a support rider for years and years and years and has just come into his own as a leader. So we're all kind of watching to see how he handles that.
One of the teams that has not fared so well in the standings and also not fared well in the anti-doping controls is Sonier Duval. That team withdrew from the race, in fact, on Thursday when Ricardo Rico, a winner of two stages at this tour, tested positive for EPO. Rico was the third rider to test positive in this tour. After the turmoil of the last few years, three riders testing positive doesn't seem like a very large number. I guess that's what it's come to, but is that a good sign?
Boy, Bill, that's hard to say. You know, reading the tea leaves, sometimes it doesn't matter how many positive tests there are as who the positives come up on. And the first two riders who tested positive were what you might call marginal riders. But Rico is different because he's a young star, finished second recently in the Tour of Italy, had won two stages. And for a rider with, you know, that sort of promise, to have been discovered cheating was a bummer for everybody. And the way he was hauled off from the start yesterday by police, detained overnight, groomed, searched, charged with a crime under French anti-doping law, they're not fooling around anymore. This country is not fooling around. This race is not fooling around. The sport's not fooling around.
Okay, Bonnie, let's get away from the dark side at the end here. You've mentioned Cadel Evans. You've mentioned Christian Vandeveld. I need to put you on the spot. Who's going to win this thing?
If I knew that, I could make a lot of money right now. Cadel is probably got as good a shot as anybody. He's still the favorite on paper. Menchov still has a little bit to prove to me in terms of being able to hold up under pressure. Christian's also an unknown quantity going into this kind of situation. So it's going to be a matter of their form on that day. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see this come down to the last time trial and really be close, as it was last year when Alberto Contador won by 23 seconds. So I hope I've successfully evaded your question because I really, I don't know. Gun to my head, I'd probably say Evans is in the driver's seat.
Bonnie D. Ford writes about cycling, among other sports, for ESPN.com. Bonnie, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
After double amputee sprinter Oscar Pistorius, the man known as the Blade Runner, failed to qualify for the Olympics in his final 400-meter attempt Wednesday at Rome's Golden Gala track and field meet, Athletics South Africa announced that he would not be chosen as a member of the 1600-meter relay team. Earlier this week, the IAAF, track and field's governing body, issued a public request for the South African Olympic Committee not to pick him, claiming he's a threat to himself and to other competitors. The IAAF also raised the hackles of Pistorius's legal team by suggesting there would be no way to ensure his blades were legal each time he ran. Now, Pistorius must devote his steely resolve and steely blades to future events. Nancy Greenlease reports.
In Rome's Olympic Stadium, all eyes are on the men's 400 meters. Not the A series, featuring the likely Olympic gold medalist. This is the B series, comprised of stellar athletes, but not the fastest men on Earth. However, this series does include one of the fastest men on no legs.
La gara dei 400, tutti in piedi! Tutti in piedi per Oscar Pistorius!
Pistorius running on J-shaped legs, lags behind the others after a slow start. He gains speed as the others start to fade, passing two competitors to cross the finish line. He finishes in 46.62 seconds, more than a second off the Olympic standard. The Blade Runner had to shave more than a half second off his personal best to qualify. That's a challenge, even for a man accustomed to leaving his doubters in the dust. But last week, with two qualifying attempts ahead of him, Pistorius already had resigned himself to going for the next Olympics.
Far more realistic. You know, I think 2012 will give me a good basis here for next year, and then 2 years to build up to the event, which is exactly what I need. So this year was going to be very hard to obtain anyway, even if we'd had from January to train.
That's when the 21-year-old started making laps around courtrooms and laboratories in Germany, the U.S., and Monte Carlo. He was fighting a ban on his artificial legs. The IAAF claimed his spatula-shaped blades gave him an edge over the able-bodied. Pistorius successfully appealed, trotting out experts who proved otherwise, but he realizes he and his legs will remain divisive.
I'm always going to have critics and people that believe what they like, and it's not my job to satisfy their curiosity because I've proved the fact that the prosthetic legs that I use don't provide me with an advantage. So at the end of the day, I mean, you know, my job's just to prove myself on the track.
The Blade Runner has certainly made an impression. He was born without fibulae and underwent below knee amputations at 11 months. Always a stellar athlete, he took up running about 4 years ago after suffering a rugby injury. 8 months later, he won 2 Paralympic medals wearing cheetah flex foot legs, and his artificial limbs were thrust into the spotlight.
As a prosthetist working 26 years with amputees, I would easily say that there was no advantage to these feet.
Christopher Hoyt is a certified prosthetist in Denver.
The energy expenditure for a below-the-knee amputee with one limb is typically about 25 to 30% more energy than the non-amputee just to walk. Bilaterally, that number goes up significantly.
The head of Biodesign Prosthetics has fit a few runners with the type of legs that Pistorius wears. Hoyt says he could easily outfit Pistorius with legs that would give him a clear advantage. Motorized artificial limbs are the next wave, from adjustable ankles to knees that will allow amputees to power themselves upstairs and athletes to perform like bionic men and women, causing even more debate in the sports world. Again, Christopher Hoyt.
The Olympic Committee is always going to have to keep their eye on every step of what's allowed in, because sooner or later we probably will surpass normal foot and have super foot.
Hoyt praises Pistorius for focusing attention on athletes with artificial limbs, but he says more research is needed, judging from the widely divergent study results presented in court. Stephen Francis, the coach of Jamaican sprinter Asafa Powell, says the Blade Runner's performances give him pause.
My problem with Pistorius at the 400 is that he runs the first 200 slower than he does the last 200, which is it's unlike what most humans do.
Francis says that's due to Pistorius's lack of lower leg muscles. It keeps him from bursting from the blocks, but also prevents a buildup of lactic acid in the lower limbs.
That is what is the death of the 400-meter runner, because when he or she gets 250 meters, their legs don't feel like their own, and they have difficulty moving it. Anybody who doesn't have that problem is at a very, very, very big advantage.
But despite the doubters, Pistorius says he's extremely happy for running fast and for making another breakthrough.
We obviously had a very controversial couple of months this year, but if I look at just the general feeling of all the athletes, tonight they came and congratulated me firstly about the court case, and you know, some of the guys tonight about the race, and that's, you know, something that means a lot to me. So, you know, I'm going to definitely go home tonight with a smile on my face.
He says no matter what, he's going to pack his bags and legs for Beijing. The Blade Runner will attend the Paralympics a couple of weeks after the able-bodied games. There, the controversy will die down. He'll be the fastest man on no legs, but not the only one. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Rome.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Mashed potato, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tomorrow marks the end of the week-long Maine Potato Blossom Festival in Fort Fairfield, Maine. The festival's final day will feature several competitions, including the always tension-filled beard-growing event, as well as skillet tossing and potato picking, even though my understanding is that one doesn't so much pick potatoes as dig them. But never mind that. The real news at the festival is that after a hiatus of several years, mashed potato wrestling has returned to the program. In fact, the grappling among squashed spuds will occur today, so if you live anywhere near Fort Fairfield, it's perhaps not too late to get in on the fun. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, hello, methylxanthine. Hello, Flovent, a postcard from asthma camp. But first, assuming Major League Soccer doesn't lose track of the event among all the tournaments currently threaded through their regular season, the MLS All-Star Game will take place on Thursday night in Toronto. The league's best, or at least their most popular, will face West Ham United of England's Premiership. Joining me now to discuss MLS as we approach the non-break is Grant Wall, who writes about soccer, among other things, for Sports Illustrated. Grant, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back, Bill.
How will David Beckham et al. Fare against West Ham United on Thursday night?
Well, they'll probably do pretty well. The MLS has a good history of performing well in these games. Like most All-Star games, the MLS one isn't taken very seriously. And West Ham is probably not as good an opponent as they've had in some previous All-Star games. But, you know, it's still a Premier League team and a chance for the MLS's best players to get together on the field.
I'm all for an All-Star game, but is there room for it in this summer of the MLS regular season where we have the Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup tournament, the Superliga tournament, the CONCACAF tournament, and various friendlies, not to mention World Cup qualifying matches for some MLS players?
It does seem a little excessive, and I think an All-Star game itself is a very American concept. But it's something that they do every year, and just as MLS has playoffs like other American sports leagues, and that's different from a lot of European leagues, I don't see it changing anytime soon.
The aforementioned Superliga tournament, in which four Mexican clubs and four MLS teams began competing last week, was designed to take advantage of the rivalry between the national teams from the two countries, the U.S. and Mexico. Has the event generated good competition and a reasonable amount of interest?
I think it has actually generated more interest than maybe people were expecting when the tournament started a year ago. Part of that reason is because the U.S.-based MLS teams are in the middle of their seasons and the Mexican teams are just beginning their preseasons. Part of it is due to the growing rivalry between the two countries. And at the same time, I think that MLS needs to actually win this tournament this year. MLS teams have not beaten a Mexican League team in a continental competition in a long, long time. And I do think most people agree now that the U.S. national team has caught in probably surpassed Mexico's national team, but the Mexican League is still far stronger and richer than MLS.
Regarding the standings at midsummer, the Los Angeles Galaxy has not been especially consistent, but they are near the top of the Western Conference anyway. MLS has to be happy about that, right?
Well, I think so. David Beckham came with so much hype last year and was getting a ton of media attention, but he was injured at first, and that was a real missed opportunity for the league and the Galaxy. He's actually healthy this season, playing pretty darn well, and his team is not bad. They're a lot of fun to watch. They score a ton of goals, and they give up a ton of goals, and it's kind of a weekly thing now to watch the Galaxy in some sort of 4-2 or 3-2 game. That's probably good for the league, too, even though the defense is so, so bad sometimes that it makes you scratch your head.
The latest MLS player to jump ship for a greener pitch and a lot more money was Brad Guzan, late of Chivas USA. He's now the property of Aston Villa in the Premiership. Obviously, they think he's a fine goalkeeper. Weigh the pros and cons of Guzan's departure as far as MLS is concerned.
Well, if you're MLS, you like to see your products go to the top leagues in the world and have a chance to succeed there. It speaks well of MLS that a 23-year-old like Guzan can make that move. He's probably the future goalkeeper of the U.S. national team and in the backup right now to Tim Howard. At the same time, it's tough for MLS because its stars are going overseas and leaving MLS, and so that's a constant process where you want to have players in your league that people will pay to see, but you don't want to keep them necessarily from going overseas to have a big payday and make the next step in their career.
Among the intriguing recent stories is the emergence of Aldis Ibrahim in Toronto. He scored his first goal last Saturday, and I think I read somewhere that he's finally old enough to get a driver's license?
Yeah, he's 16. and it's a good story, you know. He's one of the youngest goal scorers in the history of the league, along with Santino Quaranta, Freddie Adu, Eddie Gavin. And so you want to keep your eye on a kid who can score at that age in any professional league anywhere and see if he has a future ahead of him.
Elsewhere in the Eastern Conference, despite injuries to Taylor Twellman, the New England Revolution is in first place. Can they accomplish the only thing they've yet to accomplish and win the last game of the season this year?
We've talked for years about how difficult it has been for the Revolution to get over the hump and actually win an MLS Cup final. And, you know, they've got the team to do it again this year. It's really impressive how they've reloaded that team. Steve Nichol is a coach with a really good eye for talent, and they've got several youngsters from West Africa, actually, who've made a big difference this year after losing Pat Noonan overseas. And so it's a team that can win it again, but there's so much bad luck that's followed the Revolution whenever they've gotten to an MLS Cup final. You'd think one of these years they'd win it, but maybe it'll just end up being the Buffalo Bills of MLS.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated and SportsIllustrated.com, and he joins me from time to time on Only a Game as well. Grant, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Summer camps are underway for kids who love to swim, boat, fish, windsurf, and play kickball, volleyball, and badminton, among other games. Recently, Only a Game's Michelle Seaton attended a summer camp for kids who, because of their medical condition, previously shied away from those activities. She has our report.
So let's talk a little more about these medications. You take them every day?
Before they can go canoeing or take a swim, before they can sing a camp song or make a new friend, kids arriving at Camp Canonicus have to meet with a doctor. This is Asthma Camp, a five-day summer camp sponsored by Hasbro Children's Hospital of Providence, Rhode Island. At check-in, kids like 9-year-old Alex hand over their bags of medication and answer the usual questions. How often do you have an attack? When was the last time you were hospitalized? Most important, doctors ask these kids what medications they are taking. Many times, the kids don't know.
This is the one that looks for your rescue medication, so you can take when you're having breathing problems.
Camp founder and medical director Dr. Robert Klein says that the 30 kids here this week are hoping to do, and are expected to do, all of the physical activities that any other child would do at a sleepaway camp.
Exercise is one of the major triggers of asthma, so it triggers most people to have a little bit of problem. But if you do the right things, take the correct precautions, warm up, cool down, and use the correct medications when necessary, kids can pretty much do everything. It's not by accident that so many Olympic champions had asthma when they were younger. It's because if they learn to take care of it, their lungs will actually get stronger in the long run. So we really feature that they should be doing as much activity as they possibly can. Hence, camp is a great place for them.
Still, the camp employs a full team of doctors, nurse practitioners, and EMTs, all of whom are volunteers, to supervise the kids 24 hours a day throughout their stay at camp.
All the kids that we picked here are the ones that have need for constant medications on a daily basis. And we're trying to give them the opportunity of learning about their asthma. Things these kids couldn't go to overnight camp otherwise, couldn't be left unwatched. So we have the security of the medical team here, but the outcomes, the goals are still to have a wonderful time, wonderful experience at camp.
What are we doing today?
Maybe archery.
What are we going to go
to? Which is so much fun.
After they meet with doctors, these kids take on the first rite of passage for sleepaway camp. They say goodbye to mom and dad. See you on Thursday. Outside the girls' cabin, 9-year-old Isabel clings to her mother while a crowd of other campers encourages her to let go.
All right. We've got to go now, sweetheart, okay? I love you. Just give me kisses. Honey, be fine. I promise. I promise. You'll appreciate me more on the fourth day when you see me.
Exactly.
After many tears and many last kisses, Tina Perry breaks away and nearly runs to the car.
That was the hardest thing I've had to do. Poor thing. Oh, well.
The hardest thing for you or for her?
For me to let her go like that, she's dying, like she wants to stay, but, you know, this is going to be really good for her, so she needs this.
Why does she need it?
Because she needs to learn how to control her asthma. She needs to be a little more independent for her age. Yeah, exactly. Always coming to me for everything, and which is great because she's 9, but she's going to learn how to know that she can do these physical activities and she's going to be okay and she's going to learn so much here. It's so important for her to do this.
Thank you very much. Brian, jump in again, please. Right in the middle.
Outside the boys' cabin, the scene is completely different. Latsumi Pamsuvandara seems sad when her son Nathan refuses to walk her to the car or even hug her goodbye.
You don't want to walk me to the car?
No.
Nathan was just 2 years old when he had his first asthma attack, and he spent 4 days in the hospital. Now that he's almost 10, she wants him to learn to take his daily medication on his own.
It's hard for him to maintain or take that medicine while he doesn't feel like he needs it. Anytime he stopped taking it, a couple of days or something, days goes by or anything, you could see him going back to square one. Any little things he does, you could see he's gasping for air, running for quick fix, like an albuterol. And I just don't want to do that while he's young. I just want him to really, really grill him in his head that he needs that medication.
The buttercups get the first guess. So, the first thing is common asthma medicines. Okay, so huddle as a team.
Each day has its own asthma theme. One day is called Know Your Symptoms Day, and campers play games and write skits about symptoms. Today's theme is about medication, so campers are playing a sort of pharmacological family feud to show their knowledge. Campers are organized into teams, and they get spirit points for correct answers during Family Feud, and for keeping their beds made, and for doing the team cheer whenever asked. Maya, who will be 10 next month, says she's having so much fun at camp that she doesn't even miss TV. Yesterday, she scared the daylights out of her new friend Tabitha by telling her that there are snapping turtles in the lake and that they jump up and eat people. Almost as exciting for Maya was her first ever sports injury.
It's really cool, even though I sprained my wrist and I'm still having fun.
You sprained your wrist here this week?
Yeah.
What were you doing?
We were playing this game and one of the boys were running and they pushed me on accident. My wrist was behind my back and I fell on top of it. We were playing catch the flag.
The boys' team, known as the Unidentified Flying Campers, have already been in trouble for jumping on a counselor's bed. They are lagging in spirit points and yet couldn't be happier. 12-year-old Kyle says camp makes him feel recharged.
Because they keep you on track with your meds in the morning and at dinner.
So are you good about remembering at home?
No, I'm not going to lie on the radio.
You're not going to lie? Well, that's good. That's nice of you to not lie.
Let's go! Jump in!
There are dozens of camps like this one nationwide, but only a few in the New England area. Katie King is the caseworker for Neighborhood Health Plan of Rhode Island. She works with the kids on Medicaid. 19 of these campers are her patients. Every summer, she fights to get as many of her patients as she can into this free program. Hasbro Children's Hospital runs a number of fundraisers throughout the year to raise money to rent the grounds and buy food. King rents a van to bring kids to camp if their parents don't have a car. She buys sneakers and sunblock and bug spray and flashlights for the kids without them. She makes sure their forms are filled out, that their prescriptions are filled. It must be a hectic and exhausting week for her, but you'd never know it.
To me, this is the best part of my job.
Oh, yeah?
I love it. Oh, yes. Are you kidding? Because I see the kids. They've never been away. And a lot of these kids have never even been in the country. They've never even been, to a spot like this. It's a beautiful place. And, it's just...
They've never gone swimming in a pond?
No. I mean, this is a brand new experience. Everything is brand new. It's like a brand new kitten just born, and they're walking on the grass. This is how these kids are. This is brand new. So you're going to see them wide-eyed. I mean, it's just amazing. That's why I love this.
King says that her patients are changed by their experience at camp. They are more likely to take their medications, and when they do, they make fewer trips to the emergency room. They have fewer overnight stays in the hospital. They will miss far less school. But they have also done what all campers do. They've done a cannonball, cast a fishing line, whispered a ghost story, missed mom and dad, and done a little growing up. For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton in Exeter, Rhode Island.
You're listening to Only a Game. It can be argued that parents benefit from summer camp almost as much, if not even more, than their kids do. Commentator Alyssa Eli attended this year's Visitor's Day at the camp her daughter attends, and she was reminded of a valuable truth.
We do a lot for love, I was thinking, standing 60 feet up in the branches of a tree that had no interest in this accomplishment. But some of us do more than others. A group of 9-year-old campers was peering up from below, way below. "Just jump," one of them, mine as a matter of fact, said impatiently. Visiting day asks a lot of a parent. Their sweat and joviality, nicknames to memorize that make no sense, and the dead-on recreation of one's own camp past, when some rose to the summits of physical accomplishment while the rest dismally sank. I expected the high ropes to be a demonstration, which meant an opportunity to rest. But it was not a demonstration. Parents were encouraged to harness up and climb the same tree, peg by peg, hand over hand, that their children had. It was not a demonstration. It was really not even a choice. A few parents ascended effortlessly. One waved halfway up with both hands. Driven by camp memories I would rather not discuss, I managed to rise somehow, too. Then I stood on the platform and looked down. They say summiting is only 50% of climbing a mountain. The worst accidents happen in the other direction, and the arrow was changing that very second. Coming down required a small leap off the edge of the platform and an unfathomable leap off the edge of faith. Faces were peering up, but only one of them mattered. "Go already," she said. Her friends were starting to snicker. In a dream, I slipped forward. One does this for a child, along with pain for braces and college and weeping when their hearts break. The counselor tightened her ropes from below, as she did dozens of times every day, and I began to bounce down the bark of the tree. It was the stuff of heroes. But when I reached Earth, not one of the children, including my own, was there. I had hesitated, you see, and summer is just too precious for hesitation. They were all off and running towards the zip line.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist living in Massachusetts.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner. He got ptomaine poisoning.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If you thought Rafael Nadal's star had risen as high as it could go when he knocked off Roger Federer in the final at Wimbledon this summer, you were wrong, at least if you can expand the term star to include an asteroid. With the approval of the International Astronomical Union, the staff at an astronomical observatory in Mallorca, Nadal's home, has named a great lump of rock after their hero, the man they're calling one of the greatest tennis players of all time. The asteroid, named Nadal, can be seen flying through the sky between Mars and Jupiter, at least by the people at that observatory, and they've invited Mr. Nadal to come home to Mallorca to see for himself the asteroid bearing his name. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the fight. Marvelous Marvin Hagler still believes he won. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and hi to Michigan Radio. Hail to all you victors.
Hail to them indeed, and thank you for making such a good choice. After staging its longest All-Star game ever, Major League Baseball is into the second half of the season. Are you glad we're beyond the 15-inning, 4-hour, 50-minute masterpiece?
I invoked one of my few rules regarding baseball, which is that if the All-Star game is tied at 9 o'clock, I go to bed. So I didn't see the end of it, but it certainly was an entertaining show.
I'm not sure it had started by 9 o'clock. In other baseball news, sort of. Convicted steroid distributor Kirk Radomski looked under his broken television set this week and found documentary evidence that he had provided Roger Clemens with human growth hormones. So I guess that about settles that,
well,
eh?
Well, how did the television get broken? Did they serve the search warrant and break the television set and sort of drop it on the important documents? Because I know that's where I keep all my important papers, is under my broken television set.
Well, all mine, too, except for the ones that are covered with grease and oil in the trunk of my car.
Okay.
Until Tuesday night, the U.S. women's soccer team would have been considered the favorite going into the Olympics. How about now?
Well, now they're going to have to do it without Abby Wambach, who's their best goal scorer, or so I'm told by people who know more about this than I do.
They got that one right.
For example, you. Yeah, so, I mean, maybe we go with, I don't know, pitching and defense now?
We know Tiger Woods isn't going to win the currently ongoing British Open, Charlie. But
not that he couldn't from his hospital bed,
well,
by the way.
Well, stranger things have happened regarding Tiger Woods. I'll go along with you there. But Greg Norman might win the thing. What do you think? Will a shark pick up where the Tiger left off?
Well, a couple of things are going on. Number one, everybody else is being an almost complete stumble bum in this regard. And he's there. He's over there with current inamorata Chris Evert, who's always done well in England herself. So, yeah, I think it would be a fabulous story if you were to hang in this thing through the weekend.
Speaking of golf in Britain, you'll be happy to know that you can make yourself comfortable when you play a round at Frinton Golf Club at Frinton-on-the-Sea in Essex. The club has suspended their 113-year-old prohibition against going sockless.
This is interesting because did they have somebody try to do it 113 years ago and then pass a rule against it? Or were they farsighted enough to say, not only are we going to present, you know, our ground rules, what's out of bounds and what isn't, we're going to tell people they have to wear socks into perpetuity. I don't see how anybody plays golf without socks anyway, because I hit the ball so close to the water most of the time that I need dry feet.
But now you wouldn't even have to take your socks off to go into the water after the ball.
True enough.
According to Mike Pereira, vice president of officiating for the National Football League, the league has long been, quote, suspicious that gang-related hand signals might be happening on the field. So, what is said league going to do about that?
Apparently, they're going to hire some hip, deaf, dope, and fly young people to scrutinize the gestures and explain to the fathers of the NFL which are and aren't the latest hip, dope, deaf, and fly gang signals. This is going to be hilarious. This is a living South Park episode right here.
The Green Bay Packers, who don't want retired quarterback Brett Favre, who is still under contract, to come back to the team, have filed a tampering charge because they think the Vikings illegally contacted him. What do the Packers stand to get out of all this?
I have no idea. I mean, except that they definitely don't want to trade him to anyone where he will come back to Lambeau Field and win a game. You know, the talk in the Minneapolis papers, in the Chicago papers, all over football, is please get Brett here. But the problem is the Packers hold all the cards and don't really seem to know how to play them.
What do you think? Will Brett Favre be playing for somebody in September?
Yes, I think that they will get this done somehow. I think he will be playing someone. I think you can look at the Green Bay Packers 2008 schedule, and you can eliminate the teams on that schedule from where he's going, but the rest of it is up for grabs.
Even if he does end up with another team, there's at least one Wisconsin family who will continue to show their appreciation for Favre, and they've expressed it in a rather unusual way. I hope you've seen the picture.
Yeah, usually gets blamed on space aliens, doesn't it? But they carved a tribute to him into their cornfield.
All right, let's role play for a moment, Charlie. Let's say you're a marketer for Nike.
Okay.
And somebody comes up with the name Air Stab. Do you encourage or discourage that idea from going into production?
Well, I'm not a marketing guy, so I don't have a jar big enough to hold that part of my brain that I'd have to put in it for the purposes of playing this role. But I know what Nike's marketing people did. They thought it was a great idea.
Go with it. Once again, next winter, two National Hockey League teams will play an outdoor game, Charlie. Commissioner Gary Bettman announced this week that he is delighted the game will occur at, quote, one of the most historic venues in sports on New Year's Day. Do you suppose anybody's told him that Wrigley Field is a historic venue in sports because of baseball, not hockey?
I think you could tell him that you're going to play this game on the infield at Churchill Downs on the first Saturday next May, and he would have said exactly the same thing.
If you're trying to convince your employer that you should be receiving a pension because you are, quote, totally and permanently disabled, do you A, stay at home so you'll always be there when the phone rings, B, ask your physical therapist to write you a note, or C, enter a bodybuilding competition and finish eighth?
A Boston firefighter named Arroyo actually entered the bodybuilding contest, and now there is hell to pay in the Commonwealth because, after all, his employer is the taxpayer.
Wouldn't you think the guy would have at least been smart enough to finish far enough down the list so that his picture didn't get in the paper?
I don't know. I'd assume name, anything.
Anything. Everybody knows about the running of the bulls in Pamplona, of course, but are you familiar with the running of the roller derby girls?
I am not, but I have a really sneaking suspicion that it took place in New Orleans.
It was either New Orleans or Florida. It had to be one of
those.
Well,
no, Vegas was my second choice, but I know it's New Orleans.
It is. It is, in fact, New Orleans, and people dressed as if they're running away from horned bulls are running away from roller derby girls wearing hats with horns coming out of
them. Who are ferociously aggressive, as we know. And I do like the fact that one of the pursuing teams called itself the Confederacy of Punches.
It's excellent, isn't it? And there's another team called the Crescent Wenches.
Yes, Confederacy of Punches gives me hope that the classics are not being forgotten.
Exactly right. And finally, Charlie, do you suppose Bill Veeck, the godfather of all minor league baseball promotions, would have liked what went on at a recent Grand Prairie Air Hogs home game in Grand Prairie, Texas?
The Air Hogs gave reduced admissions to anyone dressed up like either Alex Rodriguez or Madonna. Now, I'm going to leave the name of the team alone, because that will get us in trouble, and our new listeners in Michigan don't need to have this show on for like 1 week and then have it vanish.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Steve Marantz begins Sorcery at Caesars, his new book about what he considers a particularly intriguing prize fight, with this contention. On the night of April 6, 1987, Sugar Ray Leonard stole a fight. The alleged victim, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, had not lost a fight in more than a decade. Steve Marantz, the chronicler of the confrontation between these two fighters, joins me now in the studio. Steve, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill.
How did Ray Leonard steal that fight in 1987?
Well, let me count the ways. This was a five-year process. It was a sting. I think that was the way I explained it. It was the conditions of the fight, the circumstances, the way he played with Marvin's psychology, the way he chose the size of the ring and the number of rounds.
I guess even the size of the gloves, everything came into it.
Everything came into play. The 12-round distance was probably the key thing, and that was kind of an interesting story in itself. Marvin wanted 15 rounds, but Leonard persuaded him that 15 rounds was the distance sanctioned by the South African Boxing Association. That equated with apartheid. Marvin didn't want to be associated with apartheid. So
even in that kind of crazy connection, this was poison.
This was poison, and in that way, Leonard cleverly positioned Marvin to accept 12 rounds.
You write that Ray Leonard sold an upright and amiable image of himself that was patently false. This was part of the preparation for the theft. How did he do that?
Leonard was tremendously popular in the 80s. He was the Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year for 1981. he was the inheritor of Muhammad Ali's popularity with that sort of style and speed and grace. But the real Leonard was something that was kept behind the scenes. He was a womanizer. He was a drug abuser. He actually had a very bad period of drug abuse from 1983 to 85 when he was retired due to his eye injury. When he returned to the ring and challenged Hagler, this was his way of pulling himself out of the depths of drug abuse.
Hagler had some depths to pull himself out of as well, didn't he?
This is true, and this was not reported at the time as well. Marvin, after his victory over Thomas Hearns in 1985, which virtually elevated him to superstar status, also went the route of Leonard, women, drugs, too much fame, tore apart his personal life.
How did Leonard's effectively selling that upright and amiable image give him an advantage in the fight against Hagler?
Leonard was Hollywood. You know, this was an era when Bill Cosby was, introducing a middle-class black character onto network TV. And Leonard sort of represented the glamour of that era. And Marvin didn't. Marvin was Main Street Brockton. And in the end, when you come down to it, the two judges probably were a bit seduced by Leonard's glamour.
We've been calling Marvin Hagler Marvin, but of course he officially changed his name to Marvelous. So perhaps that's how we should refer to him. In any case, he began feeling that there were various conspiracies against him within boxing well before he fought Ray Leonard in 1987. What was the basis for his bitterness?
Marvin had a hard slog to the top. You know, he did not have an Olympic gold medal, and he wasn't very astute politically, and nor were his managers, Goody and Pat Petronelli. And it took them a while to figure out boxing. Finally, they did figure it out, and they got the help of Ted Kennedy, Paul Tsongas. They got some help from politicians in Massachusetts, connected with Bob Arum, and got Marvin a title fight. But he never forgot that he probably had to work harder to get a title fight than Ray Leonard did.
Hagler liked to say that his motto was destruct and destroy. God knows how many school children that fouled up. But did he go into the Leonard fight with that attitude?
No, this is another way that Leonard set Marvin up. Leonard opened a restaurant in Bethesda, Maryland in early 1986, and he invited Marvin down to help him open it. And Marvin came thinking, well, Ray's retired. I'm never going to fight this guy. And they had a great dinner. They drank champagne. And after dinner, Ray and Marvin took a stroll. And Marvin confided in Ray that he didn't feel like fighting anymore. He sort of had lost his edge. His wife and mother wanted him to retire. He was cutting more easily. And that's when the light bulb went on, you know, on top of Leonard's head. He said, now's the time. I think Marvin's lost his appetite for the ring.
Ray Leonard won the fight on a decision, but when I had finished Sorcery at Caesars, I felt that in the long run, Marvelous Marvin Hagler really was the winner, because while Leonard spent the next several years thinking and talking about a rematch, you call his career an extended anticlimax, Hagler, who was 32 at the time, left boxing and moved on with his life. Did that seem to you to constitute a victory of sorts?
It was. Some people feel that Marvin set a good example. He walked away with his health intact and his money, and he didn't have this sad postscript like so many fighters do, and where they damage their health and they fight too long. So he did leave $15 to $20 million on the table. Leonard stayed too long. He took a couple of bad beatings at the end of his career. So, you know, in the end, Marvin may have set a better example.
Bring us up to date on the two principals in your story. What are Ray Leonard and Marvelous Marvin Hagler doing today?
Hagler's retired. He lives half the year in Italy, half the year in New Hampshire. He does speaking. He's a sort of a professional celebrity.
And Marvelous Marvin Hagler is no longer making, I don't know if they were spaghetti westerns, but they were some kind of adventure movie that he made quite a number of in Italy, right?
He did. He did three or four movies. He played a Marine sergeant in one of them. But, you know, the big role never came. He never got Othello or whatever he was shooting for. So I think he's just happy doing appearances now. Leonard lives on the West Coast in the L.A. area. He's remarried, raising, he has smaller kids, and he does motivational speaking. And for the last two or three years, he hosted a show called The Contender, a reality boxing show.
This is very interesting. Motivational speaking by a guy who you identify as an utter fraud.
It's perfect, isn't it? That says a lot about our country today, I think.
Steve Marantz is the author of Sorcery at Caesars, Sugar Ray's Marvelous Fight, published by Inkwater Press. Steve, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Jim Doyle, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Michelle Seaton's Asthma Camp photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from an infamous summer camper.
Hello, mother. Hello, father.
Two good things about asthma camp. No alligators in the lake, no ptomaine poisoning after dinner. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.